on last lecture in the last 2 minutes, which means I should never go over time. And it's that multiplication that it should have been the normal group, subgroup that has been rewired by this theta has a different multiplication, not the other way. So you will actually see something like this for an explicit example for tomorrow's tutorial. There is a list of references. They are all listed on Wiki. And so you shouldn't be very surprised if you have checked the Wiki. And I also hope you have done tutorial zero. I had at least download them and look at them. Okay. So today, we're going to move on to Lie groups. So first, we'll recap and talk a teeny little bit about abstract algebra. And then we'll ask ourselves a very interesting question, which we should always ask ourselves if somebody make you learn something. You should ask, why am I interested? In particular for this class, I'm doing physics program here, and why are we talking about all this subgroup and quotient group and stuff? So why should I interested in how is it implicated in physics? And then we'll learn something called a group representation. And in the end, we'll look at a few examples of Lie groups that we'll encounter for the rest of the class. Okay, so it's been a weekend. I think the first thing to do is to recap what we have learned from Friday. And most important, if this class is called group theory, what is a group? Okay, a group, all right, the definition again is a set G that comes with a binary operator circle such that it's closed, it's associative, it has an identity, and it has an inverse. Okay. And the last time we see a lot of real life examples and how they are related to group. And it will be a little bit more mathematical today, and then have an example that hopefully we are familiar with. It's called integers. Okay. Integers, well, that's a set. And we're going to choose the binary operator to be plus. That's why I really don't like when I say group multiplication. But everybody says it anyway. So binary operator is the addition. Well, it's certainly binary, such that 1 plus 2 equals 3. And it's closed. You add two integers, you definitely get an integer out, and you have it's associative. Doesn't matter which two you add first. Well, actually, it's a billion in particular, because the order doesn't matter in any sense. And the identity E is equals 0. Because you add a 0 to anything, you get anything back. And the inverse, let's denote it as minus a, known as the negative numbers. So integers, so before we leap to the Lie group, is even more than infinite. Let's look at the countable example. Well, infinite, but at least I'm able to count them. So everybody agree with me? Integers with addition is a good group. Very good. But we know integers, hopefully from very young. We have other binary operators, such as known as the multiplication. Is integers a group under multiplication? Why not? It doesn't have an inverse. Well, one has inverse, it's one, okay. Yes, you're right, this is not a group. Because it doesn't have an inverse, I count inverse 5 and I get an integer, for example. Okay, but nevertheless, integers are very interesting. Actually, if you learn about this known as the abstract algebra, what we're really trying to mimic is see all these abstract things, if we can mimic integers, numbers, something we are more familiar with. So this multiplication of integer, people still want to mimic them. So instead, we can call set these things a ring. So a ring is a set of R. First of all, it has two binary operator, such that with the first guy, it forms a abelian group. And with the second guy, the condition is much weaker. As we see, we only really just need it to be associative, and we want the distribution law to hold. So this is what we learn about integer, is that we have 2 times 3 plus 5, then we can multiply it in. Something like this. It's called a distribution law, and we want this to hold. And it should work the other way as well. So ring is really just, first you have to have a abelian group, and you have another binary operator such that it is associative and it's distributive. Just really trying to mimic numbers. And we don't even require identity, we don't require inverse, that's already a ring. And integer rings is like the first ring you encounter. It's very common, very well known. Sometimes I'll refer to it as the Lord of the Rings. Okay, so but if you learn a little bit more, if this ring actually have identity and it have inverse and in further it's commutative, so like have all the nice properties we know about the numbers, then that thing is called a field. If a ring, if this is really nice, then you obtain something called a field, which is like your real numbers. And you will probably encounter in literature some vector spaces over some field. And a field is really, an abstract field is what they are trying to mimic real numbers. And their ring is what they are trying to mimic integers. And the group is trying to mimic integers with only addition. Okay. So with this, we'll end the review and ask us these questions. Okay, math is very beautiful, but I want to do some physics. That's good. Let's take quantum mechanics as an example. Well, I shall say that it's definitely a revisit since you have a course called quantum mechanics. So everything I said the following that you should already know. Okay, quantum mechanics says we have some state, let's call it psi 1. Or, fancily, we have array, because array in the physical observable sense that it's all equivalent. So let's still denote it as this. Okay. And then we have some operator, and if it's observable, then it's called a Hermitian. Or self-joint. Then you get real, when you measure things, you get a real numbers out of them. Okay, let's consider this state, and then some later, then you get some other state, say psi 2. And then we claim that since this wave function is normally complex and we don't associate physics with them, what we try to associate physics with is the probability. So, and we claim that the probability can be calculated using this Dirac-Cat notation in terms of the inner product of the bread and the cat and square. And now we're definitely getting some positive with certain normalization. We get a probability between 0 and 1, and this is what we call physics. Okay, well, not quite. If you want it to be called a physics, something we want to respect is if your friend is looking at the quantum system on the train, then there are some, you know, some in some other places on this planet, they should get the same thing. So what I'm trying to say is consider a second observer, say prime, and the second observer, this person, that might have something saying all the states with a prime, and then look at this probability with the primes. And of course, we claim that our word has, say, Lorentz symmetry, that the observer that's moving away or some other place should see the same physics. We want to identify these probabilities. Okay, so what really we want to demand is this guy squared equals to that guy squared. Okay. So, and then we want to relate it to this state with the states of the two observers. And if it's a symmetry. If it's symmetry, then we should have, say, the physics is preserved. And if two observers are somehow related to a symmetry, Wigner has his famous Wigner theorem in the 30s. He points out if two observers are related to symmetry, then we can relate their states by an operator. And this operator should be either unitary and linear, or anti-unitary and anti-linear. So it's very powerful. It says you only have two choices. Okay, so this is something you should have reviewed in your tutorial zero. That unitary, say we have this inner product after transformed should be the same as before. So that's the definition of a unitary operator. And linear, you should definitely know that if I took a linear combination of state, which is always another state, then it should be. Then we can take out the numbers of and distribute our operator. So this is the unitary and the linear. And the anti-unitary and the anti-linear, it just has some complex numbers jumping. You get a conjugate instead. And for this case, the equals, and you A can come out, but it become the complex conjugate. Okay, so this is Wigner's statement. It says if two observers are related to a symmetry, then the states they observe should be related to each other with a unitary operator that is linear or an anti-unitary operator that is anti-linear. It's his statement, and I'll try to give a very crude proof. That we can at least say these two things work. And it takes a very long time to prove that everything else doesn't. Okay. So, but what we required is we propose that the states are related to with some operator. We'll use U because I learned about the Wigner theorem. And then what we demand is really say psi phi square is always equals to u psi u phi square. So this is what we demand. If it's a symmetry, is this physics, the probability is the same. Okay. And if you have take out a tutorial zero, you can happily say, hey, this looks like an adjoint. Adjoint, by definition of an adjoint operator, I can move one of the u over there and get something like this. So that's just the definition of the adjoint operator. The adjoint operator is defined this way, is using the inner product to define this way. And of course, now I can make an easy choice. An easy choice would be I'll just choose u dagger u equals 1, equals identity operator. Then these two are the same. And we don't care about this absolute square. I mean, whatever inside is already the same. The inner product are always preserved. Of course, the probability will be preserved. So that's the proof why those two works. Because if I choose it to be those two particular kind of operator, you preserve even something more. You preserve the inner product, not just the probability. And if you're very interested, Weinberg in chapter 2, appendix A, will have a full proof why this is the only case. Okay. So then, so now we finish our consideration with two observers. And of course, our next step is consider three observers. It's like we study 1, 2, 3, and 3 is already a large number by string theorists. Then that's like you can just take n to infinity. It's very common steps we do in physics. Okay, let's take three observers. So first we'll have this guy. State, the second guy is related to the first guy by one unit, some sort of unitary operator. And then now the third guy is related to the second guy by some other unitary operator according to Wigner. And there is a simple substitution we can do. And then we get this thing. But look, what if the second observer didn't show up? Then we should certainly be able to directly relate it to the third operator, the third observer with the first observer with some other unitary operator. Okay, kind of always depend on your partners. But this tells us U2, U1 equals U3. And if I just claim, hey, this is a binary operator that bring two unitary operators to a third unitary operator. It's a binary operator, and I have a set of all these unitary operators, and they almost look like our group multiplication. So say the same, if we want to study symmetry in physics, we should study group theory. Okay, so you might be curious and ask, well, but you know, you can always be off by a phase. Right, then I'll refer you back to Weinberg that it has discussion of projective representation that says in some case that this phase you can choose to be zero, some other more complicated that we can't choose to zero, and within this class scope we'll always stick with zero. So that phase just disappears. Okay, so let's make a very trivial but enlightening observation. Is that identity is always an operator that exists. Is it a unitary and a linear or anti-unitary and anti-linear? Identity operator doesn't do anything. The two. Unitary and linear. So for the rest of the class, I really mean this rest of the week, we'll focus on unitary and linear operators, so we'll focus on the operators that can be continuously related to identity. Okay, so that concludes the motivation. It shows up in relating observers that has a symmetry to each other, and it seems that we should study some group theory. Any questions so far? No, going too slow. Okay, let's move on to groups. Something new, not a quantum mechanics that you have already taken a class of. And okay. All right, so as you have taken classes, that we know that normally we see an operator, we don't know what to do with it. We know it's X star Hilbert space, which is a vector space. And normally we use matrix. Then we know exactly how to do things. If we don't know, we can put in Mathematica says, do this for us. So the next thing we'll talk about will be the group representation. And for the specific reason I mentioned, we would like to focus on the matrix representation. Okay. So what do I mean by group representation? Group sometimes can be a little bit abstract. And a matrix is something we can multiply them together, and matrix already have automatically equipped with the matrix of multiplication we can use as our binary operator and do stuff. So what we do is that consider we have a group and it has a bunch of elements, da-li-da-li-da-la. And the group representation says we take any element, it's a map, such that we map A to DA, which is some square matrix, we can call it M by M. And then we call this map a M-dimensional representation. Okay, so there are a few comments follows that what kind of representation we're interested. For example, let me do this. I take a group and I map every single element to identity matrix. That's certainly a lot. That is the trivial representation. Except where you successfully find one representation for all the groups you can ever think about. Just map them all to identity. But unfortunately, that doesn't tell us much. What can you learn by like infinite numbers of identity matrix multiplying each other and they still equals to identity matrix? So this kind of map is called unfaithful representation. Sometimes they will betray you. Okay, so first we're interested in faithful representation that doesn't map things to one thing. So that's possible. Sometimes you have them, and it's possible that you map several elements to one matrix, but the most time we're interested is the faithful representation that have distinct matrix to all your group elements, so that it faithfully represented the group. Now we can forget about the abstract group and just look at this bunch of matrices and multiply them together and such and such. Okay. And second, in addition to faithful representation, second, I have the following proposal. Says we find a representation of the group. So this denotes to a bunch of matrices. Then I propose that I do this. Okay, sorry, I forgot something really, really important. In order to be a representation, it needs to preserve the group multiplication. Sorry, very important. In order to this bunch of matrices actually fit, represent a group, it should preserve the group multiplication. For the case, they're all identity matrix, doesn't matter. But it's automatically satisfied. But OK, this needs to be satisfied such that we can call this bunch of matrices, a representation of a group. It's not like we just pull out, use Mexico says, generate n random matrices, then they represent, say, the CN group. It doesn't work that way. The ADNs had to preserve the multiplication. Okay. So now, suppose we find a representation that satisfies this. And I can immediately say, actually, when you find one representation, you actually find families of them. So this is what I propose, is that consider this guy, where S is just some invertible matrix. This is called the similarity transformation. If two matrices are related to similarity transformation, they are considered to be similar. So if so, the similarity is defined to be, we say A and B are similar if A is related to B precisely that way. Okay, in which sense they are similar? I always wonder that when I study linear algebra. But now, like, I can sort of say why they are similar, because suppose I found a matrix representation respect to this rule, then if I look at the guys that related to the representation I already defined with similarity transformations, okay, now it's just matrix, so this binary operator is just the matrix multiplication, and this is the inverse. So I get this in the middle. And according to the definition of matrix representation, that should be this. So I realized that once I found a matrix representation, and I just find an inverse matrix, then I get families and the families of matrix representation all respect the group multiplication. Well, they're not very interesting because they are similar. So these are called the equivalent. So we call these guys equivalent, and this is some equivalent class. So if they're equivalent, then we can study one of them. Everything we studied would be true for those similar ones. And then we should move on. So the second thing about group representation is we are only interested in equivalent representations. So first, we are only interested in faithful representation, and then we are only interested in inequivalent representations. Because the equivalent ones, well, they're equivalent. If you study one of them, the rest should be clear somehow. And furthermore, why should we use this similarity transformation for good news instead of just claim that they are useless? Sometimes you might be able to find a specific choice of your similarity transformations such that you change your group representation, so this is a bunch of matrix, and then you find all these guys can be block diagonalized. So this is a block, this is a square block, this is a square block. And this is kind of crazy. Like, there would be infinite, continuously infinite members in your group. And in some representation that all of them would be can be reduced into all these blocks. If this happens, we claim this representation is reducible. Okay, actually we'll call them fully reducible. And there is a difference between reducible and fully reducible, and George I, chapter 1.8 has a comment on them. Okay, but for us, it's the same. For all the groups we have interest in this class, if we can do this, we'll call them reducible. And suppose this square, no matter you try all the inverse invertible matrix X, S, you draw all of them. This just cannot be reducible anymore. And in the English way of defining words, this little block that cannot be reduced anymore will be called the irreducible. And what we are interested in are the faithful inequivalent irreducible representation of the group. And why are we interested in them? Well, since we have a class in the future, 2 days, called All the Irreducible Representation of the Group SU2, we better be very interested in them. And one thing to say we're interested in them is that that's how we define particles property. Okay, so the idea is if this block is reducible, and you realize one thing, the thing happening in the first block will always remain in the first block. It's diagonalized. And it wouldn't mix with other things. So every single of this block will correspond to a irreducible representation, and it stays within itself. And it's very nice. So suppose, say, aliens contact us, and we need to establish a way to communicate. And for example, as we are physicists, the first thing that comes to our mind is somehow we want to, you know, figure out how to convey the idea of there's a particle called the electron. The mass is actually not a great idea because you might try to say this thing is 511 keV, but this other people might call it in terms of, I don't know, pounds. Sometimes pounds in my mind is similar to potatoes. But the potatoes, they are not uniform. You probably use the alpacas. But the point is, because all this different unit system, when you convey with other people, probably have nothing to know about your language whatsoever. You shouldn't use these things with unit to make communication. But what you can do is you draw something like this. Even better, you can just write your Pauli matrix. It's something like a 2x2 blob. And you, at least, for the first step, you convert, communicate the information. This particle transform as in the irreducible two-dimensional, irreducible two-dimensional representation of the SU2 group, and hence has half spin. So this is something you can convey without using the units. So, and I'm really, really interested in this irreducible representation, and we'll come back to them in 2 lectures. Okay. So far, so good. Group representation, we're done. And we have matrix. Okay, very good. No question. Very good. Let's move on to Lie group then. Finally, we'll give some examples of Lie groups. So Lie group says you might have a set of elements that satisfy all this group definition or this binary operator and dali, 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 all the listed properties. But I cannot count them. There are too many of them that I cannot count. And that's when Lie groups pop in says, well, we're going to describe the group element using some continuous parameter. Let's say phi. I'll say it whatever Greek letter you prefer. And you will see that as we progress, we'll be running out of Greek letters. We'll have to proceed to use Chinese characters. Then we'll be never out of them. That's the advantage. Okay. G phi. So phi is just some continuous parameters. You might have more of them. You can use it at phi 1, phi 2, phi 3. And at some point, you get tired. It says there are too many. You can make a tuple. Says I'll say it's just a tuplet of a bunch of continuous parameters. And each element can be described by this continuous parameter. So if your group is of this type, you are not able to count. And you can describe all the members with some continuous parameters, these are Lie groups. Okay, we should see some specific example. The first example we see, well, as I said, right, you start with one. So there is our U1 group. Okay, this notation hasn't been introduced, so let's postpone this. So let's consider 2D rotation. Well, 1D I can't rotate. 2D rotation in Euclidean will be nice tower to ourselves and stay within Euclidean space for a while. And in this case, if I'm some creature in a plane, then what I can do is rotate in this one plane. And there is a very nice parameter called an angle that I can describe that, so if I have x, y axis, then I have a new x prime, y prime axis, and they will form an angle. And this angle, I can use them to describe this rotation. So this is our firstly group. It has one parameter, theta. And then you can denote all your group member as g of theta. If you want me to write specifically in two-dimensional, for example, you might have remembered some rotational matrices looks like this. And indeed, it has one parameter. And indeed, I will find the matrix are very useful. Okay, so 2D, very good. And I hope now that you know my type, you could envision the next thing we're going to do is move to 3D. All right, let's move to 3D. 3D rotation. Still, let's stay in our Euclidean space. Because I'm standing in one, then I can demonstrate with it. So if I say that let's try to demonstrate 11D rotation, then I'll have big trouble. Okay, 3D rotation in Euclidean space, then I have many choices. I can rotate in the xy plane, I can rotate it in the xz plane, I can rotate it in the yz plane. So now we have three continuous parameters describe our group. Okay, so it's like rotate like this, rotate like this, or rotate like this. Okay, so now we're going to recall something we learned from last week, is let me consider suppose I can take two of them parameters to be zero and only rotate. Okay, let me only rotate in the xy plane, which is easier to demonstrate. Just this, if you look at this guy, it's a rotation. Well, as we just said, right, this must be a group. This is a group. And if you take the other two rotations, then not existent, this is a group. So this is a group. And it contains identity by not rotating at all. And it's smaller than this guy. So hence, we conclude this guy must be a subgroup. So rotate in one of the two planes must be a subgroup of the rotation among all sorts of possible planes. And now the question, is it a normal subgroup? Someone is shaking his head. Probably not. Okay, remember how we test the normal subgroup when we say if the left coset is the right coset. I cannot demonstrate element by element because it's continuous, but I can sort of demonstrate like one of them. So suppose I rotate first around the x-axis. I rotate like this. Well, I can't demonstrate my feet, otherwise I'll be on the floor. But then I rotate around z. So now I'm facing this way. So remember this position. If I do x first, z set next, I'll be somewhat like this. But I can also do this. I can first do z and then do x. So you get something different. So if my end position is like this, you'll get a bunch of y-directed rotations. If I do something like this, then you get a bunch of x rotations. Like even if it's only a one element demonstrator, you would think a bunch of y-axis rotations are probably not going to be the same as a bunch of y-axis rotations. So it is not.
But that's just because it's not abelian, right?
Yes. I proved for a element it's not abelian, but all this element rotation around the x-axis. So if I rotate x first, and if my next move is to rotate around z, for all the element, it will generate a bunch of y-axis rotations. So now I have a set. But if I do the z rotations first, then do x rotation, you generate a bunch. So the first bunch is a bunch of like y-axis rotation. The second bunch is a bunch of x-axis rotation. So even if in terms of the set, known as the AH should equals to HA, it doesn't work. Okay, so it's not a normal subgroup. So last we kind of divided by it, met with them. Yep.
I don't know if you generate the around D axis and X axis. Is it still in that subgroup? I mean,
it's not. Like yeah. the coset. So if I take A to be an element, say G 0, 0, pi over 2 in the last entry. So what I was trying to say is I could take A to be this particular element, which is a rotation around the 2, 3. On the 2, 3 plane, which is a rotation in x axis because we're in three-dimensional. If I take A to be this particular element, then AH will correspond to some set that is related to some y-axis rotations. And HA will correspond to some x-axis rotations. And then they wouldn't be equal. Okay. In Euclidean space. Any other questions? Before, yes, question. H is this group. So I propose a group. Sorry. So H is this group. So I propose, I found a subgroup, happily. It is a group. It is smaller than the bigger group, so hence its subgroup. Then I propose I have a subgroup. Then I wonder, can I make this 3D rotation group more simple by dividing subgroup and find the quotient group as we did before? What I have to check, is it a normal subgroup? Because if it's not a normal subgroup, we'll have trouble when I do this quotient process. Then I checked, then unfortunately not. This guy is not a normal subgroup. So I have to stop here because this is seems to be, the 3D rotation in Euclidean space seems to be intrinsically complicated that I can't break it down further. Okay. It's a good point to pause and say, before I write down a bunch of familiar linear algebra equations that you will get bored, let me ask you a silly question. Among all the vector spaces, which one do you think is the most tasty one? The most delicious vector space? I propose it's the normed vector space because you would say, nom, nom, nom. Okay. Hopefully, this will keep you awake and watching me writing a bunch of 3D vector space normed and not normed stuff. Okay. So let's take this group is very important. It's not that hard, but it's very important. So let's take a revisit of this 3D Euclidean group, rotation group, which we just visited before the trivia question. Okay, so I can be fancy. See, in the 3D space that you probably have all known that I can notate a vector by a cat, and if I have some orthonormal basis, I can write it this way, right? Okay, let me write this once. That there is a summation sum, but Einstein says it's very inconvenient. It is indeed. If you don't think so, tomorrow after my tutorial, you'll realize it's better not write the summation line. Sorry. Anyway, this will be the only time I write it. But whenever you have a pair, you don't have to write it. It's understood that if you have a pair of indices, we'll sum them. Very good. That's a very good question that we'll encounter if we have time at the end of class when we talk about Lorentz group. If we're in a Euclidean, our metric is just 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. That doesn't matter, right? Yes, that's very good because we will practice a lot of like raising and lowering indices in the next tutorial and in relativity for a long, long time. But at this point, you know, we're in Euclidean. Everything is okay. All right. So this, you must look very familiar. And the 3D Euclidean space is indeed one of these very nice, tasty vector space that come with an inner product and it has an induced norm. So this must be also very familiar to you that I could have done an inner product of the x and the y, and then says I just sum x, I, and y. Okay? That can be hard. Then I say I can calculate the norm of this vector by calculate the inner product first and take the square root. Okay? Very good. And now, see, 3D rotations. What do you mean rotations? We have something and we rotate it around. And one nice fact, one nice property we want our rotations to have is to preserve the norm. If you rotate some vector, you hope that the lengths do not change. Hence, we propose that the rotation group, which we have a very good geometric idea, which is just described by all these continuous angle parameters, but we can propose that if there is a rotation matrix acting on this vector x, change it into x prime, and what I hope is that the norm of x prime should be the same as the norm of x. Square or not square doesn't matter. Right? It makes sense that if it preserves the norm, then we'll claim this is a rotation. Okay, so if we use the definition of the norm and this proposed rotation, we would say your linear algebra would tell you that if you want make a bra, you have to transpose your matrix, and you want this coming back to identity. So hence, we actually take this as the definition. So this is a matrix equation. Says that for any matrix to satisfy this equation, that it will preserve a norm in Euclidean space, then we'll claim this R are our elements. All these matrices that satisfy this equation are our group elements. Another thing we can notice is that, as I just said, that in this Euclidean space, we have a really nice metric, which is called the Kronecker delta, and which is really says it's 1 if it's equal, if it's 0 if it's not, and which is the identity matrix, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, with this metric. And you can check, if we do this rotation, you can calculate your new metric, which is the EI prime and the EJ prime, and you realize it's still the same. The new metric is still the Euclidean metric. So there are two equivalent ways of describing rotational group. One way is to say they are all the matrix satisfying this orthogonal equation. The other way says it preserves the metric of Euclidean space. Okay, well, I just said it, that these are called the orthogonal matrix. So orthogonal matrix are actually the group elements of our rotational group, and hence we shall call it the O group. And you realize, although I said we revisit a 3D Euclidean, and the good thing about using this abstract notation, throw away sums, never care about where do we add up to, is that this works for anything. So now, see, as I said, as I promised, we started 1, started 2, started 3, then we generate to anything. Okay, so we call this group either by the definition to satisfy these equations, or by the fact that they preserve the metric, the orthogonal group. But then, because I've played Mathematica too much, I realize n is not good, that it's predefined in Mathematica, which is not a variable I would like to use. So I should use the number instead, and you'll discover the famous oh no group. Okay, so what else do we want to do with this orthogonal matrices? Well, one thing we would like to do is we always like to considering smaller stuff. How can I make orthogonal matrix smaller? It's hard to say because it's continuous many, but I still want fewer of them. Okay, one way to think is that also we say identity is very important. We really, really want to stay close to identity. And this is very, very important for the next class. Next class, we'll say if we stay around identity, we have Taylor expansion. That's another tool we always use, right? Okay, let's stay around the identity. If we take the determinant of that equation, we get determinant equals 1. This is a number, 1. For transpose, the determinant should be the same. We really just get the determinant squared to be 1, so determinant r is plus minus 1. And let's take the plus 1 because we know that the identity has plus 1. And it's hence that you have determinant r equals plus 1 is very special. Since it's very special, we call them the special orthogonal group. And hence, it's called the SON. By the same argument, I want to change some other variables. So you might change your variable to what? And you get the so what group. OK. So now we have our first set of groups. That is our orthogonal group and the special orthogonal group. With a group, we'll do lots of things. Yes?
So for example, in this case, you can find a decomposition to disconnected components of the rotation group, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that any way you can write in a similar fashion to what you did before, like O n equals to S O n times something like
that? You're very good. You are very good at this. So you can actually do this. So you can actually, the SON is actually
basically you mean like you can split it into the what's the minus 1 plus 1.
Yeah. So your SON is actually a normal subgroup of ON. If we have time, we'll get there. But I want to talk about the next set of very interesting groups before we get there. Okay, but for some number of groups, one thing is very important, which is also going to be get clear next class. But like this is just something, it shouldn't be that hard to imagine that. So first, you give me a group, I would like to count how many elements are there. But if we can't count the elements, then at least I can count how many free parameter is it. We can use the number of the free parameters sort of get an idea how huge this group is. So counting free parameters. Okay, how do we count? Well, as I said, for any two plane, you will get a rotation. For each rotation, you get an angle. So you have n planes to start with, you choose two. And you can check. It works for two, n equals 2, n equals 3, and then you just assume that it always works. But yeah, that's sometimes in trouble. I can also say 2 is a prime, 3 is a prime, but it doesn't work. So we should have some, you know, more rigorous way to count. This is also nice because this time we have a geometry intuition of low dimension. Then we generalize. What if we in a scenario that we have no intuition whatsoever? So let's count in another way. The first way it says, I find two plane, I find an angle, then that's how I count. That's it. Second way says, well, I do have equations. Whenever there are equations, we can always count the free parameters as we'll count all the parameters, and each equation will get rid of them and subtract the equations. So we always have the all subtract number of equation methods. So how many equations are here? Let me make a very interesting observation such that transpose it's the same. Ah, very interesting. These guys are symmetric equations. That's nice. So now I have to figure out in the M by M or N by N matrices, if I only take the upper half triangle, including the diagonal, how many elements are there? Then that's how many equations I got. So I can figure this out, the number in this, by saying together I have N squared, but the diagonal, we need to count it one more time to split it in half. So this is how many equations, and we use total number of parameter, subtract the number of the equations, and you get the same thing. Okay, we should get the same thing. Okay, so this number is actually important. So let me make a box to identify it's important. Let's make, say, it's an O-N group. Okay. Then, of course, you will ask yourself the question, what about S-O-N group? Well, what I said is roughly S-O-N is triple O-N in half. It's like this is a three-dimensional space. I said I'll throw away everything has x bigger than 0. It's still three-dimensional. So that doesn't change anything. Both S-O-N group and O-N group has this many parameters. Oh, by the way, this is in a box because one of the interview questions you get in QFT2 would be, give you an abelian group, how many parameters are there? Okay. So this is our first type of Lie group, first series of Lie groups. They are the orthogonal groups. The special orthogonal groups, they have this many number of parameters. I'll make a note, says N equals 2, we have 1, N equals 3, N equals 4, we have 6, then we don't care anymore. Okay, any questions so far? These are the orthogonal groups. They are really just rotations, maybe in higher dimensions, but they are rotations. Yep. You probably have, but it's not necessarily a subgroup. Like you have, well, if you you prove that it has smaller number of elements and not all the these.
For example, in this case, like O3 and SO3, they both have the same dimension, right?
Right. They have the same. Yes. Yes. What you said is true. This equals in that sense. The if you only say counting number of generators, these two are equal. Yes. Yeah.
It's just the reflections, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This doesn't require a parameter.
So exactly. Very good.
You have a continuous set at some point, and you throw it
Very good. Very good point. Yes.
Can you repeat the question? Alex's question.
So the question is SON and ON has the same number of parameters? And Yan says yes, because the only thing we remove is something discrete that doesn't require a continuous parameter discrete.
What was your question about vector spaces? What was your question on? Oh, it was just that, like, if you have a vector space, then a subspace always has a dimension which is like smaller, right? What about
smaller or equal?
What about like set R to the any of ZBM? That's a subspace of the same dimension. Like a vector space? Oh.
Like if you subject all one dimension, right, then you usually have one dimension less by definition. That's what you would mean, If you really, yeah, if you project all one dimension, but if you go from R3 into the plane, then you lose one dimension.
Yeah.
Okay, this is actually pretty much related to the next set of groups. That will come back, that you actually can project a dimension away. So let's move on, because that the next group will demonstrate this, that you will find the smaller group that is actually dimensionally smaller. In this case, we're not dimensionally smaller, as Jan says, that we're only discretizedly smaller. Okay, so the next set is, you just generalize things. You say, why would we restrict ourselves to real numbers if we already know complex numbers? So you only do one thing. You just say, I'll take this almost the same equation and require that they are all complex matrices. And then, of course, transpose get something more fancy. It's called the dagger, the adjoint of the matrix. But that has some other meaning. I'll just call it U dagger. U dagger is complex conjugate and then transpose. So you say, so this thing also preserves the norm of this three dimension. You have a complex matrix, but if you act on that vector space, you still preserve the norm, you preserve the metric. So it's a symmetry. And then you just get a new equation by going more ambitious. So what does this have? Well, this is called, since it started with U, it's called the unitary group. And then, again, for the same reason, we like things to be connected to identity. Then we still take the determinant. We have determinant of U times determinant of the U dagger. Then this there's actually a difference. This one becomes the star. And you still have one. But this time, you have more solutions because we open our eyes to complex numbers. We have a solution called e to the I theta when theta is real. So you now the determinant of your group can be anything that is unimodular. It's not restricted by like 1 minus 1 anymore. Okay. But nevertheless, we'd like to stick with identity. Even if you are continuous connected, I decided to drop you anyway. So people still drop the guy that doesn't equals 1. And then we can still say it's still special. And we call what we get is the SU N group, the special unitary group. And now we can start counting parameters. So that's what we do. We look at some groups. Then we count to the number of parameters. Okay. So let's count the number of the parameters. If anybody has any intuition about the n-dimensional complex planes, please let me know. I'm hopeless in that. No, I'm imaginary. But not that imaginative. So I'll go back to the rigorous way of counting parameters by counting how many equations I have. So U dagger U equals 1. So now we start with all the parameters, all real parameters. We have 2n squared because each entry I have 2 because they are complex numbers. And now how many equations I have? Let me see my trick. The trick is take the transpose. Then I get a something. But the something doesn't equal the thing before. So unfortunately, we're not symmetric anymore. So all the equations count. We have n squared equations. And then we're left with n squared real parameters. So this is un, and you wonder, what about sun? And this time, remember, there is a continuous parameter. It's actually called a theta here. This parameter is among one among the n squared. Then we actually lost it. We say we ignore any matrices has determinant e to the I theta. We literally throw away a real parameter. So for sun, we have n squared minus 1 parameters. And indeed, we find something within the un that have dimensionally smaller. And then this formula is somehow so important that it's in box. And you will see this again, again, again in your quantum field theory courses. Well, actually, the quantum field theory too. You will see this thing in a week, and you'll be asked about this. Okay, let me also make the curious observation when n equals 2, this is 3. Well, actually, I don't care anymore. We might care a little bit in the last lecture, but for most of the time, we care up to here. Okay, let me make a couple curious observation, then we answer you the question that how I can relate a un and sun in a fancy way in a quotient group. Come back to that. But let me make some very curious, I like arithmetic fun facts a lot. So fun fact number one. I noticed 3 is equals 3. Okay. No, there's some like more important than 3 equals 3. What I meant is actually this 3 equals this 3. So you realize, huh, this is very interesting. Is there something going on with these two things? Well, at least one thing is the same. At least they have the same number of generators. Or the same number of free parameters, I should say. Is there something more? Wow, you will discover this in the second tutorial. Actually, something what we call is that the SU2 is the double cover of SO3. So for every one of SU2, you can move one, any matrix here, you can establish a map to map to two of these guys. Well, since that's discrete, thus the dimensional wise, they are both three dimensional. Well, three free parameters. So that's fun fact number one. Fun fact number two, 6. I observe 6 is equals to 3 plus 3. Okay, this is also a fun fact in arithmetic that young children might have already noticed, but they didn't realize the profound implication. So this n equals 6. Then you wonder, is there something going on with SO4 with 2 of the SU2? Since this guy is the double cover of that guy, so we throw away the SO3. Is there any relationship? And yes, that is actually the direct product, this 2. But this we wouldn't discover until the last lecture when we start to classify our simple Lie algebra. So now let's come back to the question. The very, very good question, which I always ask. I also managed to come up with a question to ask myself. Is there anything related to UN and SUN? Well, first thing I know is that unfortunately I can't draw Cayley diagram because even if I just keep drawing nodes, suppose I exist when universe was born, just drawing nodes and still wouldn't finish because it's continuously infinity. So that doesn't work. So unfortunately, we'll have to move to the rigorous mass method and then introduce something called a homomorphism. So homomorphism is just like a function. It's a map. It's a map that from a group G to group G prime, such that the group multiplication is preserved. So what I mean by that is if two of the elements multiply to a third element in group G, in G prime, then their image should also multiply together to equal the image. And this is what we call a homomorphism. And what I could do is use a finite group 2 as an example. Okay, so there are 10 dots here representing, say, 10, and I can draw these arrows to represent it's a cyclic group. Then we have our familiar C6. So I make this, I would do this, for example, by mapping every other guy to the identity, and then map the other guys to okay. So this is a homomorphism. So you can test that this bunch of guys get mapped to this. If this bunch of guys get mapped to this, this bunch of guys mapped to this, then the multiplication is preserved. So this is like 1, 3, 5, 7, 9 mapped to E, and everything else mapped to A3. Okay. So for homomorphism, there is a very interesting theorem that I'm not able to prove, but what is it stays starting with observing the fact that the kernel of this homomorphism, also known as inverse of the identity, which sometimes map to a bunch of stuff, and this bunch of stuff, well, I should write it as phi inverse E. Okay, this bunch of stuff, this stuff happened to be a normal subgroup. So this can be proof. And if you want to prove diagrammally, you can look at this visual group theory. If you want series proof, you can probably find it somewhere in like abstract algebra. Okay. And then what the homomorphism enable us is there is a fundamental theorem of homomorphism says that if that happens, if this is, as long as I find such a map phi, I can, they immediately gave me a normal subgroup such that I can do quotient. And then it gave us the image as the quotient group. Let's say they are isomorphic. So this is known as the fundamental theorem of homomorphism. It says that, okay, those quotient group, once we're out of intuition, what do we do? What we do is we find a homomorphism map. Once we find the map, the kernel of the map is the normal subgroup such that I can divide. If I divide, I get to the quotient group. And if you apply to what we have with un and sun, I can find a map. The map is called the take the determinant. For any unitary matrix, I can take the determinant, and it will map me to u1, to something like e to the I theta, as we just solved somewhere there. So it says I can establish a homomorphism from the un group to U1 group, with the kernel be our SUN, because that's the definition. Any matrix in SUN will have the U1, the identity as the determinant. That's how we define our SUN. So this guy is the kernel. That's the image. So we can safely say UN divided by the normal subgroup SUN, you will get U1, or it's isomorphic to U1. So that's how they are related in a fancy way, and hence I should stop, because otherwise the errors will come up.